Hey everyone, this is Rad.
And I'm Reed.
And you're listening to the ESA Cast. We have a really great show for you today.
How do you start a game development studio? A better question is, how do you start one after the one you are working at folded? How do you get people to follow you and believe in your vision? Today we're talking to Justin Corcoran, the CEO of Phosphor Studios in Chicago. We had a really great conversation with Justin. We covered a wide range of topics. How do you start a studio? How do you get people to come with you when you're striking out on your own? We talked about the creative spirit of Chicago and what it's like to run a studio that's not on the coasts, that's not in Washington or California or Texas or New York. We also got his thoughts on where he thinks VR and AR and other mixed reality technologies are headed and what it's like to work on multiple platforms. We had a really great conversation, and we'll bring it to you now.
Justin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Reed. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about Phosphor with us.
Yeah, happy to get into it. My very first question. So Phosphor was born out of the closing of another studio, which is Midway, which, as far as I know, was pretty much the studio in Chicago for a long time. So could you walk us through what it was like to take, you know, folks who had been displaced maybe from the closing of a studio and trying to, you know, herd cats and get everybody swimming in the same direction to build another studio from scratch? Did you have to convince people to do that? Was it a hard sell? You know, can you walk us through that process?
Yeah. Is there an aftermath or something you have to kind of work through?
Yes. It was exciting and stressful and foolhardy and all sorts of things. Was a storied studio. It's still talked about today. At the upcoming, you know, E3, they're going to be having a documentary about the history of Midway put together by, you know, one of the head of Robomoto Studios, because he came from there as well. Josh Swee put together a documentary that's going to be shown because it's such an important studio in the history of the industry. And I moved my family to Chicago a mere 14 months before it went under to work there. So it was a very big deal. There were lifers there, people who had come up, you know, as kids playing Mortal Kombat and everything else, and then had gotten to be interns there and then had become professionals there and had spent their whole career there.
Which games did you work on for Midway, or what games did you have best memories of working on for Midway?
So I was only there for 14 months. I joined to team up with my partners who ended up founding Phosphor with me, Jared Prano and Chip Sinani. They were the two other leads on a game called Hero, which you can actually still find if you go on YouTube and search for Midway Games Hero. You can find videos of our old playables. We were probably about halfway through the game. It was a great game. The team was very excited about it. It was going along very well. In a way, Phosphor formed initially as a goal to try and revive that game concept and keep it going. In 9 years, we've never finished that game concept, but our attempts to finish it have led to all sorts of exciting things for us as a group. So when we had a great team, we had a good thing going, the company went under, we all saw it happening, and then it happened. And we all said to each other, we got to find some way to try and keep this team together. We do good work. We're enjoying each other's company. So a couple of us just started trying to figure out how to get it done. We actually sat down with the founders of Robomoto, who we admired for starting their own studio. We talked to Dave Lang, who had just founded Iron Galaxy a few months before us, because he was, as I like to say, he was a little bit smarter than us and started happening a little bit sooner that Midway was going to go under. So he got out and started Iron Galaxy, and they've been around for plus a few months. We talked to both of those groups about what it's like, and we very foolishly thought, we can do this. Well, we have no experience running a game studio. We can totally do this. And the people that we talked to who were on our former team, they were also enthusiastic. I know being out of work creates a lot of enthusiasm for any opportunity to get back to work.
I can imagine.
But, Yes. Yeah. I mean, that was, that's always a big part of this founding story. It's like, hey, was it hard to get people? It's like, well, when you let 200 people go in the middle of the Midwest, when, as you know, I might know there is not, as much of a huge gaming scene in the perception of the industry. When they think there's an opportunity to get going again, they will. But, that's the jaded side of me. The positive side of me says that people were enthusiastic to come back, and, we still have a number of people who are with us back on the Hero team in Midway, still part of Foster today.
And you brought up Chicago, which is, I think, a great point, because when you think of the main industry hubs, you're thinking of California, you're thinking of Texas, you're thinking of Washington. Chicago has been home to quite a few game studios. What is it about Chicago? What is it about the place that people maybe don't associate it with video games or high-tech development, even though there has been studios like Midway or EA Black Box or other studios that have kind of set out a video game culture in the Midwest?
Yeah, Bungie started there, EA Chicago, Midway. It is such a huge hub for game development, very seasoned, talented, AAA down to indie game development. I always cite ESA's data, and I have for years, that says that typically Chicago vies with Boston for the fifth place in terms of the most number of professional game devs in a city. Sometimes Boston beats us, sometimes Chicago wins out. So it is a huge center for gaming, but it isn't thought of that way. Things that makes Chicago very unique in terms of a game dev location is that a lot of the people there have roots. They're solid Chicagoans, they're Midwesterners. They don't just have a studio end or have a project end and pack up and move, a couple miles, a couple hours south to San Diego from LA, or up to LA from San Diego, or go a little further up to Seattle, right? They like being Midwesterners. They like being Chicagoans. I am not, but I learned to appreciate that, that Chicago strength and Midwest sensibility, being a member of a studio and then a studio owner in that place.
Where are you originally from? Where'd you come from to get to Chicago?
The North Shore of Boston is where I grew up. And I had the opportunity to join Midway. And so I went out and took that chance. And I wasn't out there for long, but it was a very important part of my history. Obviously, I met the two people that convinced me that we could start a company together because they're so talented, my partners. And then we started Phosphor, and it's been nearly 9 years.
But well, Boston to Chicago is not so bad weather-wise. So, I mean, you're probably used to that.
Pretty lateral move, yes. In terms of a tech center, Chicago is a gigantic tech center. In terms of a financial center and tech center, I don't think it gets the consideration that it should. But just last year, Forbes said it was, the number one place in the country, city, in terms of venture capital returns. So people think of the Valley out in San Fran is where venture capital happens, but the best returns happen in Chicago too. They're hardworking people who have good ideas, and the same city that reversed the Chicago River, 150 odd years ago because it wasn't flowing in the right direction for the founders' needs, are the same people that are going to work very hard to make something happen. And the people that I'm fortunate enough to be surrounded with at Phosphor are a testament to that as well.
So speaking of, getting the river to flow the other way, you guys made one of the first commercial VR games, the Brookhaven Experiment, which is has an amazing rating on Steam. If anyone's ever read Steam ratings, you know how tough it can be to get a good rating on Steam. So that was pretty gutsy for a new company to go right into VR, I think, especially because even in many of the larger companies are still not exploring that terrain. So can you walk us through what the thought process there was and why you decided to tackle a new technology platform before really many other companies had even thought about it?
Sure, I'm happy to, and there are a lot of pieces that go into that decision. Part of that goes back to, again, the beginning of the studio. We have a long history of innovating, doing our best to be innovative. Midway was the first company that adopted the Unreal Engine at a studio-wide level. So they had a studio-wide license for UE3. We had a lot of Unreal developers. When Midway went under, we were able to approach Midway, who was our longest and greatest partner, to see if they could get some help for people who are out of work. They gave us our first project. They also allowed us, because of our skill in that engine, to do things a lot of small studios can't do. You know, our very first project, besides helping Epic with the engine, was to go to Microsoft and say, hey, you know, you guys are looking for Kinect developers. Here's a dozen ideas. We want to make Kinect games for you. Kinect was, you know, 10 years ago, was the new thing that everyone was a little hesitant of. No one was sure about. And we threw ourselves wholly at it. We were one of the first developers to develop for Kinect. We ended up as an unknown studio of a couple months old. We were part of the pack-in for the camera right there, along with all of Microsoft's internal studios. So that set for us of being innovative, and it also was a lesson learned for us to be innovative. And that carried forward to 5-6 years later, when we kept looking at VR and it wasn't quite there, and kept looking at it, it wasn't quite there. And then, you know, late 2015, for the Vive and for the Rift, we're finally to the point where we could do the visual fidelity that we pride ourselves on and the gameplay we pride ourselves on, and without having the nausea issues from the technology not keeping up. And we decided to get more serious, and we let people experiment with it. And the two founders that have now gone off to start CloudGate, another great Chicago studio, and make Island 359, another great VR game, they started prototyping, and we let them run with it, which I think is an important lesson for any studio that wants to survive, is you need to be innovative. And when people have good ideas, you do whatever you can to let them run with it and see where it goes. It ended up being an amazing prototype to, you know, put our very small war chest behind finishing it, even though the two original creators went off to do their own thing. And they're still doing that today over at CloudGate, and they're being very successful. We took that prototype and we took it to its limits and made the Brookhaven experiment. We had a goal of what can the technology allow? What's going to look great? What's going to feel good for VR users that have never tried it before? What's a little scary, but not too scary? What feels a little helpless, then makes you feel empowered after you played for a couple of minutes and start to feel good about what you're doing? We set those goals, and then, you know, my partners been executed on it over the course of 6 months.
Well, you guys certainly succeeded on it.
Yeah, and what I think is interesting is, like you had mentioned, is you guys had pitched Kinect games, and there was a lot of interest around the Kinect and body motion tracking, and the Wii was having its run with the motion tracking in its controller. And then when the excitement around VR and the Oculus Rift Kickstarter and the different investments started, the VR conversation really got it started. And I remember online and, you know, social media, Reddit, just the debates between gamers about whether or not this VR tech was actually going to work out. Did you guys have any sort of feelings or cold feet about VR, or did you have people on the team or investors or anyone who's just like, you know, well, this is a great prototype, but we'd rather you just made it a regular flat game, as they might say? Or was it kind of full speed ahead on the VR front?
You know, I could never say that we didn't have our reservations, and sometimes we still do now. I mean, we're on our fourth or fifth VR title, and we're still not certain where this still fairly nascent, but is going to go. But we think it's a very innovative place to create interactive experiences, both games and non-games. We're excited about it. We, in our modest way, continue to invest in it as we can. We're lucky to have partners that have come on board since the success of Brookhaven. But yeah, we were nervous. We kept trying it. We had some folks who had been in DePaul as students, which is a fantastic school for bringing up game devs. They had worked on really early, you know, Rift Model 1 games there, and had said that the technology wasn't ready yet and for a mainstream experience. And we just kept trying it. And finally, it was ready to do something that we could consider being, you know, experience to be proud of. So we went for it. It's the same thing we did 5 years before that on mobile, when people weren't sure what was going to happen with mobile. We decided after Epic proved what could be done with Infinity Blade, that we 3 months later put out The Dark Meadow, and then a year later put out Horn, two games that are still, in my opinion, some of the best on the platform. And Horn especially is something that was I think years ahead what was being done in terms of fidelity, graphical fidelity, and gameplay experience and length. And we was just, you know, it was proven to us that being innovative and taking chances worked out. So we've just continued to do that over the years.
So it sounds like you guys have overcome some fairly significant challenges and sort of navigated a very complicated landscape, which is what, you know, all developers have to do. But let's say that, you know, you're in a unique position for your size and your location. In your opinion, what are the biggest challenges that a smaller or mid-sized game development studio has to deal with? Is it pricing? Is it talent? Is it discoverability? Is it all the above? I mean, we could probably spend hours talking about that, but if you could boil it down, what would you say the biggest challenges that you have to face are?
The biggest challenge as an indie, all of the things you mentioned are there, and I've had sleepless nights over all of them at any given point. I think the biggest challenge is that there really is no steady state in this industry. We all pride ourselves on it being technology on the bleeding edge. You hear about an innovative piece of AI or graphical capability or interactivity or physical technology, software technology. All of that comes very quickly into the interactive game space. People make experiences out of it, and it's never standing still. The rock stars of this industry, sometimes people say, are the developers who really get into the guts of a game, they never can sit on their laurels of what they knew 5 years ago. They always have to be learning. So that is true at the studio level as well. You could be, the hot fighting game studio, the hot racing game studio. You can make the best tower defense game ever. But a couple years go by and all of a sudden that's not the hottest space anymore. Maybe you either need to get much smaller to serve what is now a niche, or you go away, or you find something else to do. So there is no sitting still in this industry, which we pride ourselves on as an industry, like, oh, we're always the center of innovation in technology. But it also makes for a harrowing experience to run a studio.
Yeah, I've always found that term bleeding edge to be somewhat of it's an interesting phrase, because it is the edge, but it's also bleeding. So there's a note of panic there that I think that does get translated in that phrase. I'm curious, are there... small businesses can be viewed as, not necessarily are, but can be viewed as more personal. And, if you translate it to, say, like a diner, the local mom and pop diner, people have a relationship with their customers. The owner has a relationship. Does that translate to small game development studios? And are you able to establish relationships with the people playing your games and benefit by that in some way?
I think it definitely does. There are countless studios, especially indies, that will tell you that they live or die on their reputation and on their user base and their community. We had a very interesting experience when we made a game called Nether back in 2013, in the early days of survival games on PC. Had never made the genre before, but we knew the engine. We were confident. We were approached by a group of investors who had a sort of a virtual publisher. They wanted to make this game. We fleshed out the design. We made it. We were proud of it. It was definitely like a 6-month death march, as they say, right? Just to get a game done and out into early access. It's very well received. We spent the whole time listening to the community, early feedback. We talked to them about what they wanted to hear and what they wanted to see in the game. And then we were... the owners of that game decided they wanted to take it in a different direction. And the game launched with very strong reviews and a very strong fan base that we still hear from today. And then when we didn't listen to them, we asked them what they wanted and they did not give it to them. And clearly we're not doing what they wanted, because the owners of the IP felt differently. And the game took a turn in its ratings and in its audience. And unfortunately did not last the ages like games like Rust or 7 Days to Die that have lived on their communities and their feedback. Even the Warframe story that everyone's talking about now, about a game that a studio made, wasn't sure how it was going to go, and then just listened until they got it the way that it was supposed to be. I wish we had done that with Nether, because we launched very strong and then didn't listen to our community, and that game is still connected with us as much as we never owned it and haven't developed for it for years. People still will say, Phosphor, didn't you make, now that that game was so good at first, what happened? I'm like, well, what happened is we didn't have control over the title. So we didn't get to make the decisions. And then some other studio was put on it. So yes, it is a huge part of the studio's relationship to listen.
I wanted to ask is, and you know that you had started a studio and you kind of picked up from the ashes of Midway. If a friend of yours was starting a game studio tomorrow, what sort of advice would you want to give that person? Or what would you want to tell that person as they're getting this enterprise beginning?
It sounds trite, but I would say, are you sure you really want to do this? I have Greg Boyd, our attorney out of New York City, been with us since the very beginning. And every year or so, I will hit some sort of crisis and he will say, are you sure you want to keep doing this? I told you when you hired me that this is not an easy road. And are you sure? Because the thing, we all make mistakes professionally and they're magnified when all of a sudden you're talking about, especially when you have people working for you. If you're a one-man show or a one-person show, then, you know, you can make mistakes with your one person company and that's on you. But when you have employees, it's a totally different story. So your mistakes are magnified and you will have to work very, very hard. Anyone who opens a small business of any kind from a corner store shop to a studio will tell you that if they were asked in the beginning, if they wanted to have 60, 80, 100 hour days, 7 days a week, sometimes for months at a time, to try and keep something alive that you're not sure is going to survive. We might have said no from the beginning, which is why I mentioned, you know, a bit foolhardy at the start of Phosphor, prepared to work very, very hard and know that the stakes are a lot higher. But if you hear that and still want to try and do it, then by all means, give it a try. There are amazing studios popping up all the time. I mean, like, as I said, you know, Phosphor has been a part of spawning some studios ourselves. The folks at CloudGate, our former tech director, Dan Nicolaitis, is about to launch a game with Symmetric Games that we're very excited to see. And now that he has his own studio, you know, the folks from who founded The Men Who Wear Many Hats, also based in Chicago, They had some of them and their founders are part of our studio as well. So people go off and they do it and they find success at it. And that's very exciting. But God, it's a lot of work.
I think that's a nice segue into when you mentioned, you know, your employees and what it's like to run a company. So we hear a lot, especially in tech, about culture fit. Some of it is sort of superficial. Let's try to make the workplace not feel like work. So there's beanbag chairs and free food and coffee and all that other stuff. But then there's also like trying to get people who think along the same lines, you know, within reason, so that they slide into the culture that you've already built. So how do you attract and keep talent in an industry that seems to be trying A, very hard to make work not feel like work, but B, you know, how do you keep them from the lure of California, if there is one? Or you know, how do you keep people in from saying, you know what, I'm a software engineer, I could go work for Boeing, you know?
Yes.
Why should I stay here? How do you do that?
Amazing developers, programmers who come in for a year or two and then like, this is a fun but stressful existence. I'm going to go back and, you know, to double my salary and work in finance. We're like, you know what? I totally get it. That is understandable. Because it is hard. You have to love it and it's difficult. You know, it's hard. I'm not sure how other studios build their culture. For us, culture has been about, I think the best way, underpinning of, we all as founders, we don't know everything. And we don't have all the right ideas and we don't have all the skills. I think either Chip or Jared, my partners, if hard pressed, could build a game all by themselves. And sometimes at Phosphor, I feel like they've done that. But I certainly could not. So we don't know everything and everyone has good ideas and they're all playing different things and having different influences. And for us, we want people who bring a variety of skills and interests, and then we want them to be able to express those thoughts and know that their opinions are important. And that's really, I think, the cultural consistency for us at Phosphor. I don't know how other studios work, but meetings are very open. People can bring ideas, and ultimately a decision needs to be made. But we've steered directions based on, you know, the programmer fresh out of school, who, or the designer who's only been around for a year and had one other job before this. They had a good idea and we went with it because they knew something we didn't. So that's why, because we had developers inside the studio who were like, hey, I tried something kind of fun. This is kind of cool. You should check it out. And we did. And we're like, yep.
You talked a lot about studio culture. One thing I'd ask is, what do you think of kind of the Chicago video game community culture? Is there one? And is it important that Chicago kind of has its own identity as a video game hub?
It is. I think Chicago, the game dev community, matches the Chicago identity. It's a city chip on the shoulder of Chicagoans. I love that, you know, we're one of the major metropolitan centers in the world. Technology, finance, culture, food, everything. It's all here in Chicago. But man, everyone talks about the coasts all the time, right? That chip drives people in Chicago. It's great. Again, I'm not a native, but I get to be a Chicagoan because I have a business there and I have partners there. And it's part of the culture. I think you see it in all the little studios that pop up, all the ways that people find a way when a company goes away to still be there and do something new and innovative. You know, half the companies that are there, that are working there now, that I've mentioned over the course of this conversation, didn't exist 5-10 years ago, but they've all put out hit products. Groups that made things like Octodad, a bunch of students had a cool idea, people liked it, turned into a company, and they've managed to survive since then doing that. That's really part of the Chicago scene. I mean, there isn't this, Tech Valley throwing money at a good idea culture in Chicago. It's really bootstrapped. You know, Phosphor has, I like to say we started with no employees, no money, no equipment, no IP, no office. So it was all just up from there, right? And I think that's what happens a lot in Chicago.
So this has been an absolutely fantastic conversation. I think we both really enjoyed this. I just have one last question for you, and it's a question that we ask all of our podcast guests, and you're not allowed to think about it too long. And so here's the question. What is your absolute favorite video game? You can't say a franchise. You have to pick one game, and you can't think about it for too long. Go.
The original Metroid.
Ooh. The original Metroid.
The original Metroid, yeah.
Why? What, you got any special memories of it? How did it influence you?
I mean, if I was given the time to stop and think, I'd name a bunch more, but it's the game that just convinced me that I wanted to keep playing it over and over and over again and find every little hidden energy cell and every little nook and cranny and then beat it and then go back and see how fast I could get up the jumping platform section after you beat the mother brain at the end to get up to the top to see if you could see Samus's full outfit outside of her suit, right? It grabbed me and made me want to just fully immerse myself into that world and just know everything about that game that the developers knew. I saved up my own money as a young lad and bought when Nintendo launched the first NES. I saved up my birthday and chore money for a year or two after they announced it and waiting for it to come out. And I bought that NES. I had Rob the Robot. I had it all. So I got Metroid when it first launched. Whenever the first one came out, I had seen it coming in Nintendo magazine and I got it. And I was very happy.
Well, let no one doubt your dedication or seriousness to this medium and this art form. That's pretty hard. I think I only know two other dudes that had a Rob the Robot.
Yeah, today, you probably wouldn't run into too many gamers under the age of 25 or 30 who would remember playing Metroid or even Rob the Robot, for that matter, outside of him being a Smash Brothers character.
You know, we are a dying breed.
Yes, we certainly are. I had to play the game that came in the box for Rob the Robot I forget what it's called. You had to play with your feet, right? So you could still use the joystick, because actually getting Rob to pick up the spinning gyros and drop them on the pistons was absolutely impossible.
Yeah, it was Gyroscope was the first game shipped with Rob the Robot, right?
Yeah, so you had to play with your feet. At least I played with my feet so that I could control the on-screen pistons with my feet instead of the gyros. Much as cool as the gyros were, you had to use your feet and then play the joystick with your hand.
Well, I don't think we can top that, so Justin playing Gyroscope with his feet. So we're going to end it there. But thank you very much for being on the podcast. We really appreciate it. We really enjoy the opportunity to highlight Phosphor Studios and the work that you're doing. And, you know, you have a really great story.
Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Rita. I really appreciate you guys asking us. As a humble little indie in Chicago, we appreciate when you guys take a look at us, and we'll keep that Chicago keep the chip on our shoulder and keep the Chicago spirit strong. So we appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, I want to come out to Chicago and come hang out and meet the industry now, and you know, see this chip, because I've played so many great games from Chicago. It'd be great to get out there.
You should. Foster does like a weekly outing you can go to, and then every month a lot of the devs get together and they pick a different bar in town and they all show up and they swap stories and talk and complain and create. And it's awesome. You should come do it.
Well, thank you for the invitation. We will take you up on it.
First item of news that we can really bring up is E3 tickets are finally on sale. It's the question everyone's been asking us.
Right. We get this all the time. When are the gamer passes going to go back on sale? They are on sale now. You can get them now.
Right. And here's some details about that. You can get them at E3Expo.com. They're $249, covers all 3 days of the convention, including E3 Coliseum. The one question I normally get is, does this cover the press conferences? No, it does
not.
You
have to do your own wheeling and dealing to get into a press conference.
It does not mean you cannot get into a press conference.
We had to work it on your own.
We are not going to get you that seat.
Exactly.
Someone else is going to get that seat for you. But E3 is coming up, and it just gave me a moment to pause and think about what our favorite memory was from our very first E3. Rad, how about you?
My favorite memory is one of the earliest memories I have, which is being in the ESA show office and looking down over the floor as it opened. I'm sure everyone has seen a picture of that from some year or another when the doors open and everyone comes flying in. Seeing that in person is really cool. Also, I think it was 2 years ago, Take-Two showed up with a brass Louisiana...
funeral procession.
Yeah, the funeral procession, Louisiana brass band for Mafia 3, I think it was. And man, that was cool to see that down there. Like, that's what I love about E3. Like,
that stopped the show.
People come with the greatest ideas. So
yeah, that stopped the show. That funeral band. For me, my first E3 was the year the PS4 and the Xbox One were announced. And what I remember was just being absolutely awestruck by walking into the hall where Microsoft and Sony were, and walking down this hallway that had the PlayStation logo facing the Xbox logo, and really feeling like I was in the middle of the beginning of the next gen of video games. I was at the start. I was there when it was being announced, and I was starting at ESA, and I was going to get to be a part of it. And that was really, really cool. And so now this is my sixth E3, and I still get super excited about it.
Yeah, I'm super excited too, man. I'm really looking forward to this one. I mean, I look forward to them all, but this one, I feel good about this one, man.
Yeah, speaking of events to be looking forward to, got Nighteen Night 2018 coming up. If you want to see great people like Rad and myself, as well as the industry.
Don't sell it too hard now.
Which is on March 20th. It benefits the ESA Foundation, which is our philanthropic arm. And that money that is raised that night goes to benefit the scholarships and programs that we support throughout the year through the ESAF.
And so the ESA Foundation does a lot of things. Two things that it does is it provides scholarships for young women and minorities to pursue STEM education in college. And it also runs a pretty significant grant program that helps to fund a variety of projects, really. But they're focused on kids and learning that go across the country, basically. So really, really great foundation. We're happy to support it. And NTU is a really great sort of fundraiser charity event. We have a really cool auction every year. So if you're interested, go to the website, look it up.
And that website is nighttounite.org. So check that out. So Rad and I wanted to do something real quick, because we don't just talk about video games at the ESA. We actually play them. We love them.
And everyone here plays a lot of games.
Yeah, and we've always got something new in our office break room, and we've always got something old as well. So there's a large range of games being played around here, and that's why I wanted to take a moment to say, hey, Rad, what you playing?
What am I playing? Well, right now I'm playing a few games. I'm playing Pillars of Eternity, which is still one of my favorite RPGs of all time. I'm playing it basically in anticipation of Pillars of Eternity 2, which I was able to go see and play very briefly at PAX South. I met the Obsidian team. Really great looking game. I'm really excited to play it. I started another character. I don't know about other people, but when I play RPGs, I'll start a build, and then I'll get really into it, and then I'll think, man, what if I did this? And then I start another build, and then I have like 15 of them, and I haven't finished any of them. So that happens to me.
My father's playing Skyrim right now, and he's done that same exact thing maybe four or five times.
I do it all the time. So I started, I rolled a monk, and then I rolled a priest, actually, in Pillars of Eternity, which I don't think I've ever played a priest before in an RPG. But man, he is brutal. He's really, really, really effective.
God doesn't mess around.
No. And so I like having my priest and Durance in the same party at the same time. The other game that I always find myself going back to, of course, is Dark Souls 3. Huge Dark Souls fan. I ended up seeing a YouTube video of the Crescent Axe in action. So I thought, huh, let me try that. So I made a build that would work for the Crescent Axe, and I am loving that. Pretty good in PvP. So yeah, man, that's what I'm playing.
For me, it's been the fastest selling game of all time for one of our member companies, Capcom, and it's Monster Hunter World. Monster Hunter World came out at the end of January, and we're now into the middle of February, and people still can't stop talking or playing this game. It is fantastic. If you've never played Monster Hunter before, this is one of those gamers game type games. I guess you'd say it's the type of game that if you really play games and you're really into the industry, then you know this game because it's been around and it had some humble starts on the PS2 and the 3DS. And it's fantastic on the PS4, Xbox One, and it is coming to the PC. And what I love about it is it's got a great feel to it. It feels a little bit like an MMO, but it's not. It's online. You have 16 people running around. 4 people can help you out at any time. Your friends can jump in at all times. Great community game, and you get to hunt some huge monsters.
So would you say it is the Dark Souls of Monster Hunter games?
Yeah, I'd say there's been a lot of joking around that. Is some of the reviews that said, well, this is the Dark Souls of something, and people have kind of been bringing that. When a game is hard, it's the Dark Souls of something. And this is I'd say it's a difficult game. I don't think it's the hardest game in the world because the game mechanic is built around the idea of being a hunter. You're going to go hunt this giant dinosaur. You got to find out what is he weak to, and then you need to go build a weapon that is strong in that, and then you need to build armor that's strong in what the dinosaur can do to you. And so if you don't plan ahead, the game is really hard. So, and if you do, then it's not as hard.
What weapon are you using right now?
I've been using a thing called the it's called the Gun Lance. I call it the Fun Lance. And what it is it's this giant shield and lance, but it has like a revolver in it. And so you attack and attack, and then in the middle attacks, your guy shoots bullets and they blow up in the dinosaur's face. And my favorite is you can do this attack where you attack a few times and you shove the sword into him, and then he just unloads like 3 of the shells into the dinosaur, and then you run away while it blows up, and it's really cool.
So it's a lance with a gun on it.
It's a lance with a gun.
So it's exactly. Not just a clever name. It's an accurate description of what you're playing.
It is exactly what you were doing in there. So that I've been playing a lot of Monster Hunter World, and that's what I've been caught up with about a million other gamers as well. Yeah. So, well, that's a wrap for this episode of the ESA Cast. Thank you so much for joining us, Kate and Dr. B. Appreciated the conversation. And for all of you listening, also, if any of you ever have a question about our show or want to know something about ESA or just want to engage with us down the line, feel free to reach out to us on Twitter. My Twitter account is @ReedSAlbers. Rad can be found at @Rad_Vidya. That's @RAD_VIDYA. And of course, you can get all your ESA news from @TheESA. We'll see you next time. Take it easy.